On the next episode, we speak with attorney Thomas Jacobson as we examine Milwaukee's history through the lens of justice and public memory, focusing on the lasting impact of the Jeffrey Dahmer case. He sheds light on how this dark chapter reshaped the city's legal landscape, community trust, and the pursuit of accountability. Attorney Jacobson provides a critical legal perspective on how high-profile crimes influence public policy and the justice system. This episode is a must-listen for anyone who wants to understand the past and learn from it. That's next on the Earl Ingram Podcast. Don't miss it, airing this week on all streaming platforms. Follow us on civicmedia.us or wherever you follow your podcast. Please like and subscribe as well. You know, it's often been said that there are icons in this life that you run across. There are many famous people who are recognized for being great athletes, being great entertainers, stars, if you will. But there are many others who have done things that shaped and changed the trajectory of the lives of so many people during their lifetime who across the globe may not be as well known and recognized, but there are those who have done things that have shaped and changed the history of a city, of a country. The person that I'm about to introduce you to has done just that. Let me give a little background on this gentleman before we get into the conversation. His name is attorney Thomas M. Jacobson, and he's written a book, a memoir, Against All Odds, The Fight for Justice. I mean, just a little bit about him. In his new memoir, Thomas M. Jacobson shared the remarkable journey from escaping from Nazi Germany as one of the youngest passengers on the MS St. Louis to later becoming a prominent human rights lawyer in Milwaukee, where he represented leading civil rights figures and later the families of Jeffrey Dahmer's victims. Thomas Jacobson was born in in Bromberg, Germany, after Kristallnacht. His father was arrested and taken to Germany in the Holocaust. He eventually settled in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he began a career as a human rights lawyer and successfully arguing two cases in the United States Supreme Court. He often shares his story at the Holocaust Museum in L.A. And so without any further ado, I'd like to say welcome to one and only attorney Thomas M. Jacobson. Good morning to you, sir. How are you?
Well, good morning, Earl, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. Pleasure being on your program. I appreciate this opportunity to discuss The Underdog, the book that I wrote, with your audience and some of the cases we handled while we were practicing law in Wisconsin.
But it's always best to start at the beginning. And so the beginning is, as a young man, you escaped Nazi Germany. Let's talk about that trek and that journey. For if you hadn't been successful in leaving that horrific situation, there would be no need to have you on today and the rest of it, and your history would have been different. Let's talk a little bit about that time and how you were so fortunate to escape.
All right. Well, it all came around Nazi Germany with Adolf Hitler right from 1933 on, when he became the chancellor, that Jews in Germany were at peril. And as the years went on, the Nuremberg Laws in 1935 took away our citizenship rights. And then in 1938, November, came that horrendous Kristallnacht, when so many stores, synagogues, homes were vandalized, burned to the ground. Germany, the Nazis went after the Jews. And my dad was arrested the next morning and taken to Dachau, where conditions were just horrible for the Jews there. And Then he got out in December of 38. He had 90 days to get out of Germany. And finally, a boat was made available in April of 1939 in St. Louis. We, the whole family did disembark from Germany on that boat, the MS St. Louis. Not my grandparents. They wouldn't leave. On my mother's side, my grandfather owned a department store. He just didn't want to leave. He thought that Hitler was an aberration. He could not foresee the Holocaust. Most people, nobody really could foresee that kind of a disaster. On my father's side, he was too old to leave, and he wouldn't apply. We applied for our visa to the United States in 1935, and it took 4 years for our number to come up. In the meantime, what happened, we get on the St. Louis, but it was turned away from Cuba, from the United States, and from Canada. Nobody wanted the Jews. We sent two telegrams to Hitler, to FDR, asking for amnesty, and he ignored both telegrams. So we were really heading back to Nazi Germany. And my father, what they had told him when he left the concentration camp was, they didn't leave the country, next time around, he wouldn't see the light of day again. And so he was just it was just horrendous. People on that boat, the men were jumping to commit suicide that had been in concentration camps. It was just awful. But finally, four countries took the passengers off of St. Louis. We ended up in Holland, and our number came up in November of 39. And then we were able to leave and come to the United States in 1940. And our sponsors picked us up, and we went to Milwaukee. Our sponsors were the Ostermans. They owned a factory, Fried Ostermann, in Milwaukee. My dad went to work there making parachutes until he learned language. Then he went and became a salesperson. But, you know, Milwaukee was just a very racist city at that time. Not only was it horrendous for blacks, but Jews were being discriminated against. Pennies, when they found out my father was Jewish, fired him. It was that type of a situation in Milwaukee. For Jews and blacks, it was just horrendous.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is attorney Tom Jacobson, and he has written a great memoir and book, Against All Odds, The Fight for Justice. You know, Attorney Jacobson, at that time, Milwaukee was predominantly Polish and German.
That's true. And they had a hell of a bund in Milwaukee, I'll tell you. There were a lot of Nazis running around. And, you know, you had a very isolationist country in the 1930s in the United States. You had, you know, Lindbergh, you had Father Conklin, you had Ford. All of these were anti-Semites. And we had a very isolationist policy. FDR had a lot of trouble. His concern, of course, was preparing the country for war if Nazi Germany invaded countries, which they did, and he had a deal with an isolationist Congress in New York in Madison Square Garden in 1939. 20,000 people went out to hear the Bund, the Nazis, give a big talk about their policies. So in this country, we had a lot of problems. And, you know, it's very similar today now. You've got a very isolationist country. You know, Trump, no question he's authoritarian. No question that there's definite signs of fascism. When you've got this mega movement of extreme right people that are anti-Semitic, anti-black, it's a huge problem.
So, Attorney Jacobson, before we get so far down the road, you in your lifetime have lived through historical, monumental moments. And so you have a perspective that many others don't. I mean, there are not a lot of people who are still with us who were in Nazi Germany during, you know, the late 1930s, early 1940s, who have lived and are still living to talk about that. And so, you know, the fact that you are still here and the fact that you still have such a control, your memory over those times, what do you want to say?
I was up at the UW-Madison where I got my law degree. And that's when I started my activities in the area of civil rights. I started as an activist. I was head of the University of Wisconsin Civil Rights Organization.
So what year are we talking about?
We're talking 1959, 1960.
Okay.
Long before civil rights legislation. That happened in 64 with LBJ.
Yes, sir, but go ahead.
You got your voting rights bill passed, and you got several other, you know, war on poverty.
Right.
If you look at the national setting, when I started my civil rights work, you're looking at the late 50s, Martin Luther King with Rosa Parks, all that activities going on in the late 50s, the stirrings of the national civil rights movement. And you had the Montgomery boycott, the bus boycotts. You had the Birmingham situation with Bull Connor. That's the period we're looking at. We're looking at where there was lots of agitation on a national level, and you cannot forget about Vietnam, because Vietnam tore this country apart in the 1960s. And in the 70s, you had a terrific outpouring of demonstrations from the Black community and from the young people at the university on the issues of human rights, civil rights, and the civil rights movement. And then you had Vietnam. You had these young people. Once they had people drafted again, it hit the white communities. Up until that time, it didn't affect the white community. They were able to get out of the draft by staying in college. So they didn't have to go fight. So once they were at risk, and whites were at risk, then you had a real outpouring of people in the streets demonstrating against U.S. policies. I mean, the government was lying to us right and left, all right, telling us, you know, Vietnam victory is right around the corner.
You know,
and they kept drafting more. We had 500,000 people and young men in Vietnam dying for what?
Well,
for nothing.
But Attorney Jacobson, you taking the position that you took at that point in time in this country's history was not a very popular one. I remember quite well for those who stood up and dared to fight our nation because the propaganda that was going on at that time inside of this country was, if you didn't agree with these kinds of things, you were, you know, for the lack of a better term, I know back in those days, a pinko, or you were a socialist, or you were anti-American. Kind of similar to the kind of things we're hearing today.
You got it, Earl. We're heading right down that road. You got Trump, every day there's something that he's doing has taken away the rights of Americans. Now he's going after Harvard, trying to get rid of the foreign students. He's deporting all these people without due process. I mean, those kind of issues. But, you know, let's get right into the civil rights stuff in Milwaukee. In 1962, Lloyd Barbee, he and I opened up the first integrated law firm in Milwaukee. We used to get bomb threats, Earl, for stuff that we did in the civil rights movement People would be calling our office and saying, you're going to be bombed in the morning. You're going to be shot in the afternoon. You're going to be blown up at night. I mean, there were people that were so upset about the kind of things we did. And just kind of historically, my clients included people like Calvin Sherrard, the Negro American Labor Council, 1962. You had John Givens and Core, and that was right around the time of the March on Washington in 1964, where he had the famous I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King. In Milwaukee, Core was picketing the courthouse and trying to get Eugene Goldschmidt, who was the head of the county board, to get rid of Fred Lins, who had made a comment in a civil rights organization set up by Henry Meyer, who, you know, was one of the worst mayors when it came to blacks in the whole United States.
Who had a 27...
Henry Meyer and Harold Breyer were just like the what was going on in Alabama with Bull Connor and George Wallace.
Well, you know, Attorney Jacobson, I've always said to people that in Milwaukee we had our own Bull Connor. His name was Harold Breyer.
Harold Breyer and Milwaukee Police Department, you couldn't have gotten a more racist story. They were so anti-black, it was just horrible.
And Mayor Meyer, who was the mayor for 27 years.
Yes, he was.
In Milwaukee. I grew up in Milwaukee as a young man. I lived through those times in that era. And I know the battle that you and others waged, even federally, to try to get Milwaukee to come in line with what should have been, national laws that were passed.
You got that right. Well, you know, in Milwaukee, look at some of Henry Meyer's policy. You know, he wiped out half the black community when he put in those expressways.
Right.
Brownsville, which was a thriving black community on Walnut Street. Great entertainment, barbershop, all kind of business. That was all wiped out when the expressways went right through the community and decimated it. That was a huge loss for the black community, the loss of Brownsville. Daniel Bell case, big case, 1958. Daniel Bell was shot in the back of the head by a white police officer who covered it up by planting a knife. The whole thing was suppressed when they had an all-white inquest jury whitewash the whole situation and say it was self-defense. 20 years later, one of the cops came forward and said they lied, Louis Krause. And as a result of that, they went after Grady, who shot Bell. He got 5 years for murder, 2 years for perjury during that inquest. I handled, if you want to talk about history, I mean, in 1958, Calvin Sherrard was telling me about the Daniel Bell case and how the black, whatever there was in terms of black leadership in 58, really was,
very minimal.
Calvin Sherrard, but you didn't have much. There wasn't much
opposition.
Black community. Exactly. That started really developing in the 60s with people like Lloyd Barbie, who led the movement. Father Grappi, he had the 200 nights with Val Phillips leading fair housing marches. He was arrested during one of those housing marches. I handled his defense. I asked for a change of venue to get the case out of Milwaukee, and the Supreme Court denied it. The trial judge denied it. I took it up to the United States Supreme Court. That was one of the cases that I got the U.S. Supreme Court to say the law was unconstitutional. Your venue law only allowed you to get that motion heard in felony cases, not misdemeanors. And that was what they said was unconstitutional.
You know, Attorney Jacobson, as we start building the historical perspective on what we are speaking about, I think it's important that people understand a couple other things. And one of those things particularly is at that point in time in those 1950s, Milwaukee was a burgeoning city. Milwaukee was ranked either number 11 or even more with the population because industry and middle class jobs in. And so Milwaukee was a machine shop of the world. And so people, blacks, were able to move here from the South and even uneducated and take jobs and positions that were available that gave them an opportunity to live middle class lifestyles. And so Milwaukee was on the map. It was a machine shop of the world. It's growing. The black population is growing. And there's angst in this city as black people started to make their way into this city. And so a lot of pain, a lot of anguish, a lot of, racial polarization was taking place at that time. Is it safe to say that, sir?
Yes, sir. Well, the manufacturing industry, Alice Chalmers, A.O. Smith, American Motors, and then you had all the foundries.
Right.
You were able to get good work. You didn't need a college education.
You didn't need a high school education.
A lot of African Americans were hired to work in manufacturing. They all had good jobs. That's another issue that the credit clothing companies, you got these merchants in the black community that were selling stuff, a dollar down, dollar a week. They were using a law called garnishment to get their contracts, get the people to pay for what they were purchasing. And Wisconsin allowed 17 states garnishment before judgment. You could tie up a working person's paycheck before you even proved that, that person owed the debt. In other words, that was the garnishment that would tie up a person's wages. They would get a small subsistence allowance, and the rest of their money would be tied up. And then weeks later, you'd have the opportunity to go to court, say whether you owed it or not. But in the meantime, your money's being tied up. What happens if bills, like if you had a car payment, if you had your rent due, and things would just get out of hand because of that awful law? And you had other policies, you had for welfare, women, you couldn't have a man in the house at night if you were a single woman getting welfare. So they would have what they call skip tracers, these credit clothing stores. These guys would sit there with cameras waiting outside the home of these welfare people, trying to catch them with a man in their house. And then they threatened they would take away their welfare check if they didn't pay him money. I took that garnishment law to the United States Supreme Court. Again, I always would lose these cases in the lower courts because we had judges that were very discriminatory. In Milwaukee, they were pretty conservative. You had a very conservative Wisconsin Supreme Court. So I would lose my cases there. Take it to the United States Supreme Court. I took the garnishment before judgment case there in 1969. They declared garnishment before judgment unconstitutional. So both cases I took, I got victories for working people, for low-income people, for the African-American community, for consumers. Those were historic, important cases.
So if you are just joining us, my guest is attorney Thomas M. Jacobson. He's written his memoir, Against All Odds, The Fight for Justice. Just want to say to you, sir, I remember so well the federal government was passing these laws. And so those of us who aren't attorneys, can you help us understand? If the federal government was passing the laws, the states create their own laws. Do the states have a responsibility to follow the federal laws, or who has the control? Because you had to take those state laws that were preventing, freedom and equity and opportunity for people of color, to the Supreme Court on a national level to fight for what was passed on the national scene. Can you explain that to us?
Well, again, the Constitution is the basis of the rule of law in this country. You're supposed to follow the Constitution. And you got the 14th Amendment, which gives you due process, where you have a right to go to court and be heard if they try to take away your liberties. It's called due process. Garnishment before judgment, that case that I took, that gave due process. That gave the right of a working person to be heard before they take their money from them, whether or not they owe the bill or not. Something as basic as that. But they didn't follow that in the state court. They carved out what they said was what the law was supposed to be. Well, I took that interpretation up to the United States Supreme Court and told them to tell the state Supreme Court they're wrong, that the Constitution, 14th Amendment, says you've got to have a hearing before you can take a person's paycheck, that you got to give people a right to have a motion that they can take a case out of a city that's as racist as Milwaukee. Is that case was for Father Grappie. You know, people hated Father Grappie in Milwaukee because he was always agitating for the African-American community. Lloyd Barbie, he did a lot of good, you know, with the desegregation laws. I drafted the complaint with Barbie that eventually desegregation Milwaukee, again, the United States Supreme Court. It was John Reynolds that said that was unconstitutional. De facto segregation, and that changed. That would have been in probably that decision, I think, came down about 1976. So, we used to have busing in Milwaukee, and they used to take African American kids out of the school in the inner city, bus them out into the suburbs, and then keep them separate from the white kids that they. At the school they were being bused to, kept separate lunches, segregation.
So Attorney
there
Jacobson.
All going on in the 60s.
So Attorney Jacobson, I have to tell you that I'm one of those young people who was impacted by that. I lived on 4th and Monarchy. I went to Garfield Avenue School, all black from the time I was in kindergarten to the sixth grade. I was then bused into an all white school where exactly what you just said, we were separated at lunch. We were given two separate educational tracks. We were discriminated against. We were assigned seats in the cafeteria for the black students. The white students could sit wherever they wanted to sit. But the battle that you and others fought that opened the door for my family to move, when the housing legislation passed, where they were forced to allow blacks to move into different parts of the community, was that 1967 or
that would have been
open
64.
Housing? Oh, 64. Okay.
Yeah, that was when the Voting Rights Act and the Fair Housing and all that kind of thing, that all came out of Johnson in 1960. He was phenomenal when it came to domestic issues. I mean, Johnson, remember when he passed that Fair Voting Rights Bill?
He took a lot of heat.
We shall overcome.
Right.
As the President of the United States, a Southerner from Texas, saying that. I mean, he was great when it came to issues, you know, with the war on poverty. He was fighting to get money into the communities for low-income communities to be able to articulate for themselves what was good for them. That was a big change in attitude about how social programs should be run. So Johnson was great. What destroyed his legacy was Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam, the man had, you know, he was paralyzed by this whole business of communism and that, you know, we had to take a stand and we, the domino theory, all that nonsense that the federal people were telling everybody to support the Vietnam policies that were just killing our young people. It was a civil war over there. You know, Ho Chi Minh, he wanted Vietnam to be unified. He wanted the country to be able to have sovereignty and decide for themselves what was good for them. He wasn't the communist that was going to be aligning himself with China and with Russia. He was an independent. Yes, he was communist, but that was a fault of the U.S. We wouldn't negotiate.
You know, Attorney Jacobson, I have to say to you that hindsight is always 20/20. And as you know, I have had time, and many from my generation have had time to weigh the segregation, the anti-segregation movement. That we stop and we pause and we say, well, when we had our own intact communities, we had our own businesses, dollars circulated inside of our community, and maybe we might have been better off had we remained segregated, because Milwaukee was just such a horrible place, and it was slow to want to change and open the door equitably for this integration. But hindsight, again, is 2020, and history is always the best barometer. I would say to you that in the long run, the opportunity to move outside of an area where we were locked into and a growing community was good for us to be able to have free opportunities, not quite free, because even to this day, some question whether or not America is still, open and right as it relates to civil rights and those kinds of things. But it certainly is a long way away from where it was before you started your battle and your trek into the work that you and others put in. I say thank you and a job well done. Let's move on to a horrible time in Milwaukee's history. Milwaukee has been known for a lot of things over the decades, and clearly some of them were, you know, Laverne and Shirley. And so Milwaukee was always looked at as a backwards beer-drinking town, and that's basically what we were known for. But you know, this horrific thing that took place with a man named Jeffrey Dahmer, who, for those who don't know, let's talk a little bit about him. There's been many different movies written on Jeffrey Dahmer. I don't know, four or five different movies that have certainly been put together. They're continuing to do all sorts of documentaries on Jeffrey Dahmer. Let's talk about who Jeffrey Dahmer, the infamous Jeffrey Dahmer, is and how you got involved.
Well, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer murdered 17 young men in the most horrendous way. And I don't want to go into all the details of what he did.
What year did that begin?
You're looking at probably 1980s, right? In there.
Right. Early 1980s.
You got it. With my involvement,
Attorney Jacobson, before you go there, let me give a little. So Jeffrey Dahmer was a 17-year-old white male who worked at a chocolate factory and who was a homosexual, who enticed young people, mostly people of color, to come to his abode and to get high, maybe smoke some weed, and he then drugged those people. and in many instances, you know, dismembered them in a horrific, horrific manner. I don't know how many there were total, Attorney Jacobson, but there were many. And this went all over the world. And really big case, really big issue. How did you get involved?
I got hired by some of the families of the victims of Jeffrey Dahmer. I ended up with eight families, and there were 11 that eventually joined I sued Jeffrey Dahmer. I got for my eight families about $100 million in judgments against the man.
But he didn't have any money initially.
Exactly. That was really the problem. I got the judgments, but then how do you get the money out of a guy that doesn't have two nickels to rub together? So that was my task, to figure that out. So how I started was I actually set up a deposition of Dahmer, where I had a face-to-face with him at Columbia Correctional Institutions, where I questioned him for over 2 hours. And essentially, what the whole purpose of the deposition was, is how are you going to pay the $100 million you owe my eight clients? So out of that came a couple ideas that I had. Number one, I wanted him to write a book. He would write a book about himself, how he got to be such a sick person, when doing all these horrendous, terrible things that he did, his lifestyle. If he wrote a book about that, we would film it. Then we would sell it to the highest amount we could get from somebody, and we would give the money to the victim families. They would share equally in that money. When I questioned him about that and told him of this idea, initially he was going to think about it, and then he was stalling, and I ended up figuring out he had money in a bank account over $12,000 from sick people that were sending money right from around the world. They loved Jeffrey Dahmer. If they could get a piece of correspondence from him, they'd send him money. That $12,000 I garnished sheet, that got him to agree that I could go to L.A., figure out if I could get anybody to buy the rights to his story and doing a movie about it. I got $1 million deal out here in L.A., but he wouldn't go through with it because his father wanted to write a book. Lionel Dahmer wrote the book. The family got the money. Dahmer wouldn't participate. So other than getting money out of that bank account he had with people that sent him money, I came up with the only other way I could figure out how to get money for the families. I seized all of his property. It was property that was in his jail cell after he was murdered, and then the apartment complex when he was originally arrested. That's where he had the vat that he boiled on the body.
Attorney Jacobson, hang on. For those of you who are just joining us, I am joined by Attorney Thomas M. Jacobson, who's written a memoir, Against All Odds, The Fight for Justice, a book that's out. We'll tell you how you can get it. You can certainly go to Barnes & Noble, The Grove, 189 The Grove Drive, Los Angeles, California, 90036 USA. One of the things, and why Jeffrey Dahmer had so many allies and people who believed in him, he was a handsome, blue-eyed, blonde guy. And so
you got that right.
Like an actor. And so people,
that's why so many people, you know, really got attracted to him, women especially. There was one gal in London that sent him $7,000. When they asked her, why'd you send him $7,000? She would only tell him if they paid her. So one of the tabloids there gave her a lot of money to tell her story, how she got all this stuff from Jeffrey Dahmer. cost her $7,000 to get that kind of stuff from him.
You know,
that's the kind of attraction that he had.
You know, Attorney Jacobson, you say that you went after and you tried to entice, because you live in L.A. now and you've been there for a while, you tried to entice the movie outlets, Hollywood and others, to do a movie. There have been many movies since that have been made, and those movies and the rights to those things have no connection with what you were able to try to get for the families. Was there a time that that request that you had for the families in that $100 million ceased to have any teeth? Did that finally come to an end? Was there a sunset?
I got all that property of Jeffrey Dahmer, and I threatened to have an auction. I was going to sell off everything to the highest bidder. And Joe Zilber, a big philanthropist
in
Milwaukee.
The Zilber Foundation.
He came forward and he said, look, this is a horrible thing. He got in touch with me. He said, I don't want to have this auction. It'll give Milwaukee a tremendous black eye if you have it. Destroy Milwaukee's reputation even more. What'll it take to not have that auction? How much? I told him $1 million. He ended up giving us $420,000.
Which was an awful lot of money back then.
You bet. And 11 families shared that money. And I never took a fee. You know, all the defense work that I did for people like Grappi, for people like Barbie, for people like Sherrard, for Kaur, for doing all those kind of cases. Mike McGee was my client. He did a lot of good things when he was an alderman. He was frustrated. He was the alderman for the African-American community. The most blacks lived in his district. He tried to get things through the Common Council. Just nobody wanted to do anything for blacks. And he got very frustrated. You know, he spoke out. He had Good Morning America, where he did a big demonstration to highlight how blacks were mistreated in Milwaukee. They tried to, when Jimmy Carter came into town, they asked him for a quote about what he was doing with Habitat for Humanity. He said, look, blacks don't need charity. What blacks need are jobs. And they tried to then get him out of office. I had to defend him against that, and we won that case. I defended McGee 5 times, and I got him off every single time. They never got him convicted every time they went after him when I was his lawyer.
So I remember all of those times and things, Attorney Jacobson. As you sit here now and have had time to think about your life story and your life's work, you certainly had an opportunity as an attorney, as a defense attorney, to become wealthy had you chosen not to go into civil rights. If you had to do it all over again, would you do it the same way and why?
Anyway, I'm so happy with the life I've led. I spoke out. I never was willing to be quiet. I couldn't be co-opted. I wouldn't take jobs that required me to be shut up. Henry Meyer offered me a job to be the consumer advocate for Milwaukee. I wouldn't do it because of his civil rights record. And I knew what it would be if I worked for Henry Meyer. I couldn't speak out on civil rights anymore. So I'm proud of what I did. And you know, life isn't always about money. I mean, the years I was with Barbie, we never made 2 cents. We had no money at all. I lived on 9th and Meineke. Lloyd and I had shared an apartment together when we were partners. It actually lasted 6 years of partnership. You know, it's kind of a cute story I tell about how the partnership ended. Barbie was at a black power conference, 1967. Rap Brown, they were all there in Washington, and he came back. I'd never heard of black power in 1967. But, you know, I said, Lloyd, what's black power? He says, well, Tom, here's what it is. you keep doing all the civil rights work, but I'm going to be out front talking about it. So, you know, he was asking me to take a back seat. So basically, you know, I had to think about that. And finally, I said to Lloyd, you know, Lloyd, it reminds me of a Rosa Parks story, but I'm not going to insist on sitting in front of the bus. But I'm not going to take the bus. I'm going to get off the bus.
So let me.
And that really was the end of our partnership.
So I grew up on 4th and Monte Key. So
yeah, that's what you
didn't live far from where I was growing up.
Yeah, I was right in the apartment. Elizabeth Coggs, Beth Coggs, and Ike Coggs lived in that apartment when we first moved to Milwaukee.
Well, because blacks all lived in a certain segment, a certain part of town. We were locked into that.
It was just super hyper segregated Milwaukee.
Yes,
the worst.
Let me ask you, because you are still clearly a man who is engaged in what is happening today. When you see the fact that I state that, you know, all the civil rights gains of the last, you know, three generations have been taken away, affirmative action, diversity, equity, and inclusion, all of the different entities that were put in place during your struggles and your fights to make sure that people got fair and equitable and equal representation in a nation that claims that's what it is, those things have been dismantled and taken away. And very little, if any, conversations are being had nationally about those things. What do you say, sir?
Yeah, way too quiet. I mean, people, I think, are stunned at the rapidity and how fast this was done. I mean, you know, you took, you know, that Project 225 that Trump lied about and said he didn't know anything about. That's really what they're following. And they were ready for this. Once Trump won, he put in all the extreme people to head up all these committees and in his cabinet. And he was ready to dismantle everything that was done for human rights, for blacks, for African Americans, and of course, for anybody that was over here as a immigrant.
Right.
That's the policy that he uses to get his base excited. He's going to do everything he can to get rid of foreigners in this country. And I'm going to tell you, it's going to get a lot worse than it is. Now, I tell you, the only way you're going to be able to resist and fight until the next election, and believe me, you better be nervous about that next election and what Trump's going to do to voting rights and how fair is that election going to be. Yeah, because he's got his army ready. He's got all those January 6th people that he pardoned that are going to be like, you know, the brown shirts in Nazi Germany that did the, you know, beating up of people in the streets. So he's got those kind of people ready to go. He's got control of the Department of Justice now. Yeah, it's his law firm. They're going to do whatever he wants. He's got the cabinet. He's got both houses. He's got the Senate and he's got the
Supreme Court. The Supreme Court.
Yeah, and he's got Supreme Court, so he's got everything. So what is the answer? It's the answer you saw in the 60s. You're going to have to hit the streets. You're going to have to demonstrate. You're going to have Milwaukee when we had the school boycotts. You remember that, Earl?
Yes.
And to get, you know, the school desegregation highlighted, Barbie, there were three boycotts. That's when Dick Gregory came into town to help with the boycotts. That's when he got arrested, when he participated in the housing marches. Those housing marches.
Well, Dr. King was in and out of the city.
And Martin Luther
at that
King
time.
Came several
Absolutely.
Times. He never got arrested, but he was here. But you know, if you're gonna, you gotta get your voice heard. Don't get intimidated. Don't be afraid to speak out. You're gonna lose your freedom. You're going to lose your right to be able to think the way you want to think. Already, you know, Earl, you were talking about it. They're taking away all the affirmative action. They're trying to get rid of all the kids at the colleges from foreign countries. They're going to go after anybody that speaks out because they've got control of the U.S. Supreme Court. They've got the Department of Justice. They got these nuts now that are running the military. I'm afraid what's going to happen to the military. You're going to find the military used by Trump to stifle defense once we hit the streets in big numbers, like what happened with the Black Lives Matter movement. But that's what you got to do. You got to speak out, resist, and protest. Don't just sit there and complain. Don't just sit there and let it happen without speaking out against it. Get your people that are in Congress to do the right thing. You're going to have to vote. You're going to have to participate. Just don't step back. Don't be afraid. You know, speak out. There's a lot of us still around that are willing to do whatever it takes to help get this country and democracy, keep it the way, you know, historically, democracy always has been a problem. You know, it's our country, it's a wonderful country. I came here with nothing. When you think about it, that I came out of absolute nothing with Nazi Germany. We had to leave everything there when we got out of that country. We didn't have two nickels to rub together. But, you know, I got an education here. I went to work. I was selling shoes. That's how I got through college. And then, you know, we always made enough money, Barbie and I, to keep the doors open. We were making a lot, but we did keep the door open.
So,
and we really were able to, you know, fight for freedom. That was all about.
So, Attorney Jacobson.
Decades late after, you know, I left Barbie, you know, I had the Bell case that I handled. I got a $1.8 million judgment against the city. And then when we did the Dahmer stuff, we got from Zilber that money for the families of Jeffrey.
So, Attorney Jacobson, I want to say you are going to be in Milwaukee June 16th and 17th.
Yes, sir.
And where?
I'm going to be seeing you on that Tuesday that week that I'm going to be in. I'm in town for June Tuesday. So I'm going to be in town Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Tuesday night, I'm going to be doing an event at the Wisconsin Historical, you know.
Yeah, Historical Society, Black Historical
yeah,
Society.
Benson's organization. They're going to
be I will be there. We will be there.
That's
Civic
great.
Media will definitely be there. You're going to do some book signings?
Excuse me?
Are you going to do some book signings?
That's what I'm going to be doing.
Okay.
I'll be there with a whole bunch of books. I think you and I were going to try and do something.
And we're going to make it happen. We're going to get you on the air. But more than anything else, I think it's great.
The 18th, right, Earl?
Yes, sir.
June 18th around 10 o'clock.
Yes, sir. We'll get all this taken care of. But I want to thank you from the depths of my heart, number one, because as a young man, what you did for my family, for my generation, who was given close to fair opportunity in a city that was not known for being fair and open and right to people of color. You and the fight that you waged with Lloyd Barbie and others in a lifetime struggle for justice has made a difference in the lives of so many like me. And so we owe you thanks.
The book called Underdog. It's Against All Odds, Fight for Justice. You can get it on Amazon. Just go to the website. You'll see it under Underdog Thomas Jacobson. Just look it up. You'll see the website. You'll see the book. You can get hardcover, softcover. You can get Kindle. We look forward to seeing you in June, Earl.
And again, you can get it Barnes and Noble starting June.
Barnes and Noble, I'm doing a book talk here in Milwaukee.
Yeah, June 29th.
In L.A.
June 29th, 2025, 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Barnes and Noble, that's in L.A. Okay. All right. So.
But you can get a Barnes and Noble, too, in Milwaukee. Just go ask for it.
So anything you want to say before we part for now?
Well, I want to thank you, first of all, for giving me this opportunity to talk about the book. I really appreciate it. I want to tell your audience, don't despair. We are in a horrible time again, but the answer is to fight and resist. That's my last message. Fight, resist.
What a great life story of commitment and service. And I can't wait to see you in person. And it's been, you know, one of the highlights of my life to be able to talk with an icon like you. I remember as a young boy your name being mentioned, and especially the memorable Lloyd Barbie.
Well, thank you, Earl. Bye-bye, everybody.